действия некой пятой колонны.
Пятая колонна – это система управления.
Предатели Родины, которые сеют панику и раздор, изнутри разрушают.
Пятая колонна в России добивается Майдана, интервенции.
Предложили пятой колонне депутат
партии власти.
Навального раскручивала пятая колонна.
Кто входит в пятую колонну? Кому удалось вышибить? Fears of sackings, arrests and purges abound. Talk of fifth columns is pervasive on state media. Rumors swirl that the Soviet-era institution of exit visas may make a comeback. And wary of surveillance, officials are ditching their smartphones for older, less fashionable, and less traceable models. Meet the new Putinism. It's different from the old Putinism. We don't really know if Vladimir Putin's imperial adventure in Ukraine was driven by domestic politics, by geopolitical concerns, by fears about what an example a democratic revolution in Ukraine might set in Russia, or by a perfect storm encompassing all of the above. We don't know if the Ukraine campaign was planned long ago or was launched ad hoc when the opportunity presented itself. And we don't know what Putin's true intentions are in Ukraine or beyond. But what we do know is that the Ukraine crisis has fundamentally and probably decisively changed the way Russia is ruled. And in the brave new world Russia is entering, the soft authoritarianism of the old Putinism looks positively quaint and almost benignly liberal by comparison. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow's Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hey there.
And also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. Welcome, Sean.
Hello.
And joining us soon via Skype from London will be journalist and Kremlin watcher Ben Judah, author of the book Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. And I will welcome Ben when he joins us. So pragmatism is out. Ideology is in. The collective Putin is out. The rule of the Siloviki is in. Integration with the global economy is out. Autarky is in. Modernization is out. Empire is in. And China as a model is out. And China as a patron is in. These are some of the ways that I see the new Putinism is different from its older incarnation. Now, I know we've tread over this ground a lot before. But I think it's useful to step back and just take a look at just what has changed, how it's changed, and put a little bit of a framework around it, because it has changed pretty damn fundamentally in the last year or so. Mark, what do you see as the fundamental differences between the old Putinism and the new?
Well, I think I'd want to break it down into two separate sort of ways of looking at it. One is the idea or the ideology behind the regime, and the other is the system, the mechanism whereby it applies that ideology. And my view is actually the mechanism is still essentially the same. We can talk about differences. I mean, I think there is still a collective Putin. It's just a slightly different and much smaller collective Putin. I think I'd challenge about the rule of the Siloviki in that I think that misplaces where the real power is. And likewise, modernization is clearly still in the sense of he would rather a modern military than not modern military and that kind of thing.
But modernization of the economy is out.
Well, no. I mean, I still think he wants modernization of the economy. It's not that he doesn't want it. I think it's what has changed is the ideology or the idea behind it. And in a way, that also dictates what the priorities are. At what cost modernization, for example? I mean, I think it is clear that we have this new model Putin is much more nationalistic and much more, I think it's fair to say, isolationist in his nationalism. It's about protecting Russia from outside influences and cosmopolitanism and such like. And to that end, for example, I think modernization takes a back seat, not because he doesn't want it, but because he's deeply aware of the consequences of, for example, deeper integration into the global economy, into global sort of patterns of thinking and such like. So I think that's the difference. We see a Putin who's trying to take Russia in a different direction. His ideology is different, but his tactics, his measures are still, I think, highly recognized. It's still basically a rule whereby you corrupt, you bribe elements of society.
What about taking away things like the deofshoreization campaign, like taking that away? Doesn't that reduce, because it changed the social contract in a lot of ways. The old social contract, steal as much as you want, keep your money offshore, but be loyal or I'm going to come down on you. Well, now that part of the equation seems to have changed, and that is an essential element of the old Putinism that I'm not sure is going to work in the new Putinism, no?
Oh, well, whether it's going to work is another issue. But the old social contract still had limits. It still had parameters. It wasn't actually steal as much as you want. They were very, very generous. I mean, exactly. It was, you were able to steal as much as you're entitled to. And obviously for some that was much more and for some that was less. There were other things you couldn't do. I mean, the same way as, in a way, the social contract that was struck with organized crime was not don't do crime. It was don't do shootouts in the streets that undermine the authority of the state. So there's always been limits. What we are definitely seeing is a redrafting of, shall I say, the appendix to the social contract that specifically define the limits. And yes, whether or not that's going to work, that's a separate issue. But I still think, as it were, the basic model, which is an essentially cynical relationship with elements of the elite that tries to say, look, you give us political obedience and in return we will give you opportunities for enrichment, that still stands. The question is whether in this new model, as it were, the terms will be enough to satisfy people and whether or not it actually will be affordable.
Now, I'm sure you both saw the comments that Volodin made at the Valda discussion group yesterday. Mm. As long as there's a Putin, there's a Russia. Without Putin, there's no Russia. Has it, to a degree, become all about Putin? Now, you say the collective Putin is shrinking. I'm also thinking the collective Putin is becoming less of a collective and more of a rubber stamp. No,
I suppose it depends who's collective Putin. I mean, if we're talking about the old collective Putin, then increasingly there are people who I don't think have that kind of power anymore. It was interesting because you'd flagged this up in some offline stuff about the new Minchenko report, Politburo 2.0, in which he tries to look at how the sort of post-Ukraine, the sanctions era, things have changed. And his view is, you know, some people have gone down. Medvedev, that's a surprise. Proof that there is
still
no,
in the
there is no flaw.
He's
still in the Politburo because he still performs a function. But I mean, he says that the beneficiaries have been the three Sergeys, mm-hmm. Shoigu, Ivanov, and Chemezov. Now, I'm not quite sure about Shoigu, whether he really has that kind of power, but that's trivial. But I mean, I think it is still clear there are people who matter. The point is, this has always been a court politics. This has always been about who gets the ear and the eye of the president. Now, what we find, though, is I think it is clear that even Russia's minimalist and weak institutions are being degraded, to use the current sort of terminology, if not quite destroyed. And therefore, what we find is, yes, in this current model, it is ever more presidential. And in that respect, very rare do I end up saying I agree with Volodin. But in this respect, he's right. Without Putin, there is no this Russia.
There is no this Russia, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, his role as the sort of the central linchpin is all the more important. But I don't think we should assume that, for example, all policy originates from him. I don't believe it does. Mm. I still think he's a person who decides from options that are presented to him by the grandees.
Now, one of the most interesting, I was just able to skim the Minchenko report so far. I want to read it in much, much more detail. God, I wish I had time to read it in full before this podcast. But one of the top lines is that basically Putin has managed to consolidate the elite. With the Ukraine crisis has served to consolidate the elite, the inner circle of the elite, the collective Putin, if you will. And that talk among the inner courtiers of a succession is now off the table. That was the kind of the top line that I saw. But again, I've got to read this a lot more carefully than I already have. Sean, what are your thoughts on this?
I actually want to shift and think about Putinism or the new Putinism in relationship to society. One of the things that strikes me is that you have a much more interventionalist Putinism in terms of how people think, how people behave, and the narratives they use to understand their life. It's definitely a more ideological Putinism, but you get a series of these laws, like the laws against homosexuality, laws of blasphemy, this anti-cosmopolitanism campaign. All of these seem to play a role in this new Putinism, and the old Putinism seemed to keep society at a distance. Seems to be a social contract where society does what it wants as long within certain parameters, and the government rules. And now we have a far more interventionalist Putinism in this way.
So in that regard, I mean, in mobilization, as we've discussed in this podcast in the past, becomes a key element of the new Putinism. And you have to wonder how long this mobilization can last. And I'm happy to say that Ben Judah has just joined us, and we're just 5 minutes in. Ben, we were just starting out, just talking about how the new Putinism is different from the old Putinism. I know you just wrote a fascinating piece on the state of affairs in Russia right now. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, sadly, a lot of those ideas about Putinism were sort of drowned out by a scandal surrounding the Speaker of the Polish Parliament. So I'm really glad to be able to talk about them. I think that if you look through a kind of cross-section of different aspects of state-society relations, you see a very decisive shift that's happened since the Ukraine crisis began. There's been a definite shift in Russian media. There's been a closing down of editorial freedom in many newspapers, especially Kommersant, and there are moves now to end editorial freedom at Vedomosti. I think the Russian press has become a far more constricted affair. I think Russian television has moved from one level of hysteria to another, going from extreme spin to deliberate hysteria and rabble-rousing. I think you had a clear shift in the internet, in which there are decisive moves now towards establishing a sort of sealed, almost withdrawn Russian internet model, but perhaps even more closed off from the world than the Chinese variant. I think there have been steps, exactly as Sean was saying, to establish sort of patriotic mobilization as one of the basis of the regime. There's been a change in foreign policy. Whilst America's pivot to China was mostly fictional, I think that Russia is actually attempting to make a pivot to China in terms of its energy politics, in terms of its foreign policy. I mean, there's been a shift in terms of the economy, and there's been a decisive rollback of the influence of authoritarian free marketeers and a push towards statism, state control, state interventionism, which has been manipulated by which sanctions have enabled those supporting state-driven industrialism to manipulate. I think when I was in Moscow and speaking to a lot of people in the political class, there's definitely a shift of influence in terms of who Putin is speaking to and who Putin is surrounding himself with. Obviously, it's extremely hard now, as ever, to do any Kremlinology, but it appears to be that Putin is surrounding himself and listening to the people that won him Crimea, and those are, for the most part, military intelligence services. And depending on who you speak to, people will say that the GRU is either more influential than is perhaps more influential than before. But I think I'd like to ask Mark what he thinks about that.
Yeah, no, I mean, and this is interesting what you said. I wanted to get Mark's reaction, because one of the things Mark was stressing in the beginning is that what's changed basically is the ideology, but the mechanism largely remains the same. Ben, along the lines of what you were just saying as well, we have also fear in the elite. This is something you've alluded to in past podcasts. Earlier this week, I was in Rome for the Transatlantic Security Symposium, and I was speaking to a former Russian foreign ministry official who was really interesting, not just what he said, and what he said was pretty much on the money, but the sadness in his and the fear you can tell that he had about what was going on. He seemed so pained. And when at one point we were talking, he's in the think tank world now, and he said, you know, take a look at my website, but, you know, bear in mind, I can't write everything I really think right now in this environment. But I'm trying to be as professional as possible. And I got a kind of a little whiff of some of the things you were talking about that you came across in Moscow. Mark, why don't you jump in here about what Ben's saying about the increased influence of the GRU in this new configuration?
Yeah, I confess I don't really see the GRU's role. The GRU is really quite limited in its function. It is a military intelligence service, and that's what it does. Now, thanks to Ukraine, it clearly has managed to prevent the quite dramatic potential erosion of its power. I mean, there was talk of it losing its G and becoming a mere directorate of the general staff, which actually carries with it all kinds of other implications about access to the president and so forth, but, you know, fairly arcane. But it doesn't have any kind of a wider role. The head of the GRU is still a relatively junior figure within the military hierarchy. It doesn't have a kind of a business empire the way that the FSB does. And the notion Sechin was almost certainly GRU at some point, a military interpreter, quote unquote. But even so, I mean, I think there's a long way between now and where he actually still had any kind of real traction with or was regarded as one of them by the GRU. So, I mean, I don't necessarily see the GRU, but on the other hand, if we're talking about, as it were, the wider sphere of the security apparatus, I mean, then absolutely this current regime plays to them. But I think the interesting thing is, I mean, to go back to what you said earlier about this sort of the extent to which the current crisis has allowed a consolidation or forced a consolidation of the inner elite. Well, true enough, because for two reasons. One is because if Putin is the only game in town, then you want to be close to Putin. And secondly, there is that sense that they are being assailed and, as it were, the lesser elite are increasingly sort of uncomfortable. And in some ways, what's happening is more of a sense that, as it were, the moat between that inner citadel of the people who are closest to Putin and the outer Kremlin of the rest of the Russian elite, never mind ordinary Russian society, but even the rest of the Russian elite, I mean, I think that moat is getting wider and wider and wider. And therefore, how far it's a sort of, it's an optic element. Is the elite really getting, the inner elite getting more consolidated, or is it just getting further away from everyone else?
What about...
I'd just like to repeat that most of the people I spoke to in Moscow didn't really know who this new elite were, and they were mostly speculating that it was GRU, or they were naming different intelligence agencies, and I think that came more out of confusion than out of any certainty. I think it's just very important to stress always in these podcasts that the people that we're meeting and that we're talking to don't really know, and they have little bits of information. They know more than us, but that moat that was just mentioned is definitely there, and it's definitely getting wider. And I think a lot of their stress and paranoia is as much about seeing it get larger than knowing who exactly is on the other side of it.
Yeah, no, I agree. And there has to be, as we've all noted in recent podcasts, there has to be some kind of degree of epistemological modesty in analyzing Russia right now, because it has become it's never been transparent in the best of times, but right now it's pretty as opaque as I've ever seen it in the post-Soviet time. Mark, I also wanted to get you to react to some of the things Ben was pointing out here, the shutting down of the formerly free media space, what was left of it, the constant mobilization. These do seem to be changes in the mechanisms. Are these changes in degree or kind?
I mean, for me, exactly, they are changes in degree. And I appreciate they are dramatic changes in degree. But this has always been a society in which the state has reserved to itself the right to decide the parameters. It has, even before, and I think it's worth budding. Just to pull back one thing, I don't think this actually started with Ukraine. In some ways, I think what we have to appreciate is the extent to which Ukraine was both a symptom of a shift that had taken place within, if nothing else, the sort of the confines of Putin's head, as well as absolutely an accelerator of these processes. But the point is, this is a regime that, you know, had anyway very much wanted to and achieved consolidation of its control over the television media. It had allowed the print media to be much, much freer because, if nothing else, it felt it was so much less important and, you know, its circumstances were less vital. Now it's beginning to encroach on that. But it's just simply, sort of, again, it's redefining an existing social contract. Now, okay, in dramatic ways, but I don't actually see this as a true step change in how it operates. I think it's just the particular parameters it types into the machine of government.
Right, and it's almost a philosophical question about when differences of degree become differences of kind. Sean, did you want to jump in here yet?
Yeah, I think the one question we need to ask is if this is a permanent change or is it temporary. Because I agree with Mark that this really kind of started when Putin came back for his third term, and Ukraine really accelerated a lot of these processes. But the shift that occurred when Putin came back was a response to Bolotnaya. Mm-hmm. Essentially, a response to the protests. And one has to wonder if this is going to be the permanent character of this kind of a late Putinist era, or is this going to be a limited time once things begin to calm down, there's going to be a pullback from by the state back and a loosening up of things.
Yeah. No, and this gets, Sean, I'll stick with you on this one. This gets to something that I've been thinking about, this dilemma of soft authoritarianism, right? Was the old Putinism sustainable? Was this soft authoritarianism of the old Putinism, this laissez-faire authoritarianism, where basically the authoritarianism was restricted to political activity? Let's face it, they weren't really trying to mobilize the society. Quite the contrary, they wanted to leave the society alone and the society to leave them alone and just let them rule. Was the old Putin sustainable, or did it have to change into something? Either something more pluralistic, which is what we all thought it was coming when the Bolotna protests first happened in late 2011, early 2012, or conversely, something more authoritarianism. Could the old Putinism survive, or did it have to change into this or something else?
I think it had to change one way or the other, because the old Putinism was based on a balance between state and society. And when the society started to flex its muscles as a result of the Duma elections and you had these mass protests, the Putin regime had to respond in some way. It could either allow for the protests and make a deal with them, make compromises, and then have this new reconfiguration of a more pluralistic system, or it could react as it did, as in a hard way, and put down the opposition movement and consolidate itself. So I really think the fact that society began to change really put the question forward to how the Putin regime should respond.
Mark, would you agree with that?
I definitely agree that it had to change. I mean, if nothing else, every system has to change and has to modernize, and that's always the real challenge, is how do you evolve but maintain your own control? But just to also pull up on this point about whether or not it can go back, which I think it's an excellent question to ask. I don't think it can. I think there is a limit to how often you can actually play this sort of this game of, you know, first of all it's good cop, then it's bad cop, and then be good cop again. And in many ways, if one looks at the genesis of Bolotnaya and so forth, it was precisely the castling. It was precisely this sense of having seemed to promise a slightly more pluralistic, a sense that, okay, within, you know, again, limited parameters, there was scope for changes in leadership and so forth. And then you're saying, aha, no, that was just, it was purely a temporary little gambit and I'm back. That's precisely what generated some of the pushback.
That was the
proximate cause.
That was the proximate cause. The underlying cause was the kind of the increased wealth in society, the maturing of this middle class, or seeming maturity of this middle class.
Well, that wasn't necessarily cause, but context. I mean, I think there are other ways in which actually this soft authoritarianism, this hybrid regime, could indeed have stayed ahead of the curve. Mm. The particular approach they showed. I mean, they could have, let's say, stuck with Medvedev, stuck with a sort of a much more kind of inclusive model. And frankly, I think things would have continued well enough, at least until the economy started to tank.
Right.
But instead, they, you know, for whatever reason, again, I think this is again symptomatic of Putin increasingly regarded. I mean, I think, you know, Putin believes, I think, no Putin, no Russia. You know, and he felt he had to return, and then so many other things cascade off right. that, and then you have Ukraine and this. So, I mean, I think in a way a definite decision has been made that this regime, I don't believe, will be able to successfully roll back from.
Yeah, no, that September day back in 2011 was decisive. And again, Sean and I both, back in the day, we thought this is where it was going. We thought, because it was the smart thing. It looked so smart that they were going to be able to stay ahead of this. But if they had kept Medvedev in, and Putin still would have ruled, like, as Deng Xiaoping, so to speak. Ben, what do you think? Do you think that did this soft authoritarianism have to change, or could it into either something more authoritarian or something more plural, or could it have stayed ahead of the curve and continued?
Well, I think what's more important now is that the Kremlin clique believe that they had no choice but to go down this path. Mm. And there's lots of interesting discussion about these analyses that were run about what was undermining the regime and how to answer this. And they have come to believe that certainly the internet had to change, and there was an element of inevitability in that, that certainly there were aspects of ties to the West, aspects of globalization that needed to change, such as intelligence officials being able to leave the country, that they believe that kind of contact had to be closed. And I think they believe to a certain extent as well that they were going to either have to give way to a lot of the protesters' ideological demands or they were going to have to come back and answer them. And I think that's an expression of this deep-seated dialectic thinking that many of them have.
And there, but and yet there were those in the elite at the time that did want the authorities to meet the protesters halfway ideologically. Well, even people like Surkov.
I just don't. Well, I think that we have this problem when, as Russia analysts, and I think we have this problem, and whether or not we work as journalists or academics or diplomats or bankers, is that we only meet a tiny fraction of the Russian elite that's interested in meeting us. Mm. And we meet this small kind of liberal, and even though they vary in their degrees of authoritarianism, these people that may range from like Kudrin all the way to Shuvalov, and they're kind of acolytes. They give us a very, very distorted image of what the people around Putin think, because we're simply not meeting, and as individuals we may meet some of them, but as a whole, we're just not meeting the people around Patrushev. We're not meeting this deep state within the presidential administration. We're not meeting the people around Bortnikov. We're not meeting the vast majority of the Russian elite. And I think this gave us a kind of skewed view, which is we analysed, I think very astutely, the mindset of someone like Shuvalov, that he was more interested in thievery and in corruption. He was an authoritarian who wanted to rule in one manner in Russia, but place his money in London and freely move between the two. But I don't think we ever really got a sense of the majority of the Russian elite with epaulettes. We don't really know very much anymore about Russian military thinking, what they're telling Putin. We don't really know that much about it.
Mark knows quite a bit about this.
Well, of course, with the honourable exception of Mark, I think there's a general analytical failure in the community.
But Mark, because this is something you watch these people for a living, and what picture would you paint from that then? Because,
well, I think yes, we always have to appreciate there are limits to what we know, and let's be blunt. I mean, even within Western democratic and transparent systems. Sometimes it's very hard for us to know exactly who is influencing whom, and where the really important discussions take place. You know, is policy really decided over the kitchen table or over the poker game rather than in Parliament?
Or on the golf course.
Yeah, I mean, but on the other hand, if we look at the Russian system, yes, of course. The problem is that, as it were, the people who are now calling the shots are exactly the people who are not giving us interviews, are not chatting with us, and often exactly their hench people are not talking to us. That said, I mean, I think one can look at the kind of ferment and coding of opinion that we do see in public statements, because if nothing else, Russians have for decades been very good at that. That's how discussion takes place in these metaphorical Aesopian sort of terms. You know, I mean, for example, the military, I mean, you know, it is clear that the military do not at the moment feel they're being listened to particularly. Now, on the other hand, the fact that they're still getting a lot of goodies means that any edge to that conversation has been blunted just simply by the provision of large amounts of money. That always works. But nonetheless, I mean, I think it's clear that the military do not regard themselves as being part of the decision-making process. Mm. Same for the Interior Ministry and such like. I mean, in the FSB, again, yes, they clearly sort of have traction, but it's traction which is mediated through precisely figures like Patrushev and such like. I mean, I think that the interesting thing is actually an old model of politics, which is interest group based, does not apply. It's very personalized now. And yeah, the very key people, they're all within that black box that we can't penetrate.
Right. No, and along the lines,
I think the research agenda of the community of Russia experts as a whole has to basically kind of follow Mark's research agenda for the time being. And I think the dominant...
I'd advocate that entirely.
I think the dominant research agenda was more or less looking at Kremlin liberals, what they thought, translating their views, and that Mark's area of study has been woefully neglected for the past 10 or 15 years. And from experience, European diplomats simply do not spend time reading, thinking, or analysing these Siloviki. And I think that's something that we need to change, right, and quickly.
Well, something.
Ben, there's a drink in this for you at some point.
Mark will be much in demand, I'm sure. Something along the lines of Sean was raising about how permanent this change is going to be. And I saw a piece that I put up on my blog last week about how over the last 18 months, the FSB has been, or the security services writ large, have been actively recruiting young people in their 20s and 30s from the provinces, from poor backgrounds, without roots, whose basically brains are a blank slate and you could download any ideological software onto, and they're bringing them to Moscow to form the mid to lower levels of the elite. And I immediately thought of Stalin's class of 38. This is not to make a direct parallel, but this phenomenon, Stalin's class of 38 ruled the Soviet Union from the death of Stalin until the rise of Gorbachev. And you have to wonder if a bunch of little Putin clones are being brought into the bureaucracy now that you can overplay that, of course. But it's something to bear in mind. Sean, did you?
Yeah, I think even though you're in a way, as you put it, that are a kind of political blank slate, we can't really say that they're going to carry on the same type of Putinism in which they came up, because even if you want to use the Stalin analogy, the class of 38, Russia, Soviet Russia, was an incredibly different place after Stalin died than it was when Stalin was in power. And there's always an opportunity, even though Putin might bring these people up to become the new little Putins of the future, this doesn't mean that they're going to keep Russia the same under the same banner of Putinism.
That's a good point, Sean, because the class of 38, their watchword was caution, stability of cadres, above all stability. They grew up came up in the atmosphere of fear, and they wanted to avoid that and avoid chaos at all costs. And that's a good point. One of the things
I had a chance to meet a few of these people recently in Moscow, these kind of younger people who've been kind of brought in and are being very quickly empowered. And what struck me most about my recent trip to Moscow was how sudden people my age in their mid to late 20s had, in the space of 6 months since the Crimean crisis started, moved from being at the very fringes of their ministries, the very fringes of politician circles, to right at the heart of them. And there are a couple of traits I know from sort of drinking with especially one of these people, is a lot of frustration about efficiency and a desire that if we are to be authoritarian, this authoritarianism should be done properly and that it should not be done in a kind of half-assed, corrupt way. And the watchword is efficiency, effectiveness. And there's a lot of mythology about China. There's a lot of mythology about the war being against criminal oligarchs that we have already destroyed, or criminal oligarchs that lurk within the system. It's about, there's a lot of the crimes of the 1990s being committed by these criminals that are still around us. I've noticed that's quite prominent, and because these people come from provinces that suffered very badly during the 1990s, they really believe this in a way that the previous elites, which were far more Moscow heavy, I don't think really did, because life in Moscow is obviously troubling in the 1990s. It wasn't as awful as it was in, say, Vologda. I noticed as well that the distrust and dislike of America is far, far, far bigger, because it's a post-Iraq war view of America that they've either encountered in parts of the Western internet and then spliced and mediated through Russian propaganda. Mm. And that's very important. You know, it's very quick that they will tell you that you can't trust America because of weapons of mass destruction and so on and so forth. So that's far more sincere.
No, and Ben, you mentioned China, which provides me with a brilliant segue. In a few moments, we'll continue our discussion of the old and new Putinisms. And as part of that, take a look at the central role China has played in both of them. I would like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City is co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, is Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh Center for Russian Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. And joining us on Skype from London is journalist and Kremlin watcher Ben Judah, author of the book Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You can read the Power Vertical blog at rvrl.org, and you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
Relations between Russia and China continue to develop successfully and have reached a principally new level of comprehensive partnership and strategic cooperation.
In the old Putinism, it was an example to be emulated. In the new Putinism, it's a sponsor. Call it Russia's China syndrome. During Vladimir Putin's first two terms in the Kremlin, officials said they sought to follow the Chinese model of authoritarian modernization, a dynamic economy and a tightly hierarchical political system. I'd like to quote Olga Krishnanovskaya from something she said to me back in 2007 describing the goals of Putinism. Quote, "They want an authoritarian modernization. They want a strong authoritarian state of the Soviet type without the Soviet idiocy. The idiotic Soviet system and the idiotic Soviet ideology were minuses. All the rest, they want to bring back and preserve a state system without a separation of powers." This was the path China followed. For people in the security services, China is the ideal model. They see it as the correct course. They think that Yeltsin went down the wrong path, as did Gorbachev. End quote. But now, well, the idiocy seems to be back. And with the Kremlin abandoning modernization and with Western sanctions depriving Russia's unreformed energy-dependent economy of access to the financial markets, Moscow is looking to Beijing, but it comes at a cost. Rather than following the Chinese path, Russia appears to be dooming itself to becoming China's junior partner. But was China ever really a relevant model for Russia? And is it at this time a realistic partner? Mark, what do you think?
No, I think what we're talking about is a mythic China. Mm-hmm. A mythic China that sort of has dramatic economic dynamism, but at the same time serried ranks of just simple sort of loyal Chinese citizens. Well, we actually know that neither of these is entirely the true story. I mean, actually, sort of China's economy does carry with it certain sort of seeds of problems in the future. And at the same time, that, you know, China also has deep sort of internal divisions, and its political consolidation is really a byproduct of economic dynamism more than anything else. But this is nothing new. I mean, I can think back to the sorts of debates that were being had in 1990, 1991, in which you perversely had these Soviet hardliners actually looking to China, Singapore, and God help us all, Pinochet's Chile.
Yes.
As examples, this is the model that Gorbachev should be taking. In some ways, it's a little bit like, I mean, I was struck when hearing Ben talk about this sort of this new elite and their drive for, if you're going to be authoritarians, it has to be efficient authoritarians. The whole bubbling up and bubbling down mythologization of Andropov as this sort of poster child of the honest, effective authoritarian, which again, you know, is in many ways only part of who he is. People need, for their debates, they need to have something to point to, and they have this mythic notion of China. It is a model that would be completely inappropriate economically or politically for Russia. It's just a shorthand for basically saying we want to have the money so that we can be obscenely corrupt and import Carrara marble for our countertops, but we also want to have all the powers of political authoritarianism so we don't have to worry about the masses or indeed the sort of the meso masses, the middle class and such like. So I mean, I think that it just talks about this hearkening for people who want this ideal solution. And yeah, because absolutely China is not an example. It is not a sponsor. Frankly, the best way of describing China at the moment, given Russia's desperation, is that China is Russia's loan shark.
Well, that's where I'm heading. Yeah. In terms of China as a model, Mark, I completely agree with you. I mean, you have to remember a couple of things about China economically. But they do have a manufacturing base that actually makes things like the iPhone in my pocket, for example, that the rest of the world wants to spend a lot of money on. That's number one. Russia has nothing of the sort. But also politically, if you look at the Chinese political system, the presidency rotates every 5 years. the presidency rotates every 5 years. I don't think Russia's prepared to do that, even within the tight circle of the ruling elite. I don't think they're prepared to rotate the presidency every 5 years, but that's how China does it. Ben, you look like you want to say something.
Yeah, well, just to jump in here, just like one point I wanted to make in the previous section, but because I wasn't there for a chunk of it, I'm just going to make now, is I do not think that Western sanctions have the capacity to break the Putin regime. And I do not think that the Russian population will rise up during the coming recession. I think they've been too brainwashed. I think they're too prepared to swallow it. And I think that the national mood and the way people think has been changed by Crimea in a significant way. And we're going to see, of course, how significant. I think that we're going to go into quite a dark recession for Russia. There will be a rise in unemployment. There have been cutbacks to state corporations. There is an outside risk of capital controls having to be imposed. And I would like to propose that the best way to look ahead for Western analysts and diplomats would be to have a graph in mind of how bad the recession could get, and have another one of every rumoured piece of Duma legislation to control the population being planned. The worse the recession, the worse the Duma law. So if we're looking at a recession of -2-3%, expect goodbye to Facebook, Skype. If we're looking at a recession a bit deeper than that, expect the rumoured law that all internet servers should only be provided by Ross Telecom. I'm just speculating there, right, but I think that's a good way to think ahead of what we're moving into.
That's a rather frightening scenario. As the economy gets worse, the repression also gets worse.
It's simply because the current sanctions in their current setup cannot break the Putin regime, and the West is not willing to break the Putin regime. And at the highest level, people do not want to do that, and that hasn't even been discussed. So all we have right now is sanctions that are going to dramatically worsen a recession. And the likely result of that is that it will dramatically worsen the repression as they try and respond to their anticipation of unrest during this period as it comes along. And I think we can also think the lower the oil price and the more sustained the oil price fall, the more current rumours of repression will be implemented. I think it would be useful for the kind of analyst community to try and form a kind of database of things that we're hearing of rumoured on the horizons and try and anticipate them. I've noticed there's a lot of discussion in opposition circles in London, because London is more than ever the capital of the Russian opposition. There's a lot of excited talk about this recession. It's only started in the past month. You have the Navalny circle are very excited about coming mass unemployment, and they're very excited about coming capital controls, and they think this is their moment. Right. Interestingly, Khodorkovsky's people, they don't think that at all. They're playing the long game, very slow. Khodorkovsky's got a very long-term, maybe 10-year game plan. He's a 51-year-old guy, and slowly, 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 Khodorkovsky is trying to take ownership of causes. I was just at the Oslo Freedom Forum, which is a slightly bizarre sort of Davos for human rights defenders, and it was fascinating to watch how Khodorkovsky had taken ownership of the Bolotnaya prisoner case by becoming its patron and champion. So he'd taken a form of protest and activism that basically had nothing to do with him. And none of those people went out with Khodorkovsky in mind, and he used his own story, his own money, to take control of that. And it was very interesting to watch him networking with Mr. Verzilov, the manager and, dare I say, controller of the so-called Pussy Riot band, and again, taking ownership of them, slowly building up influence. Mm-hmm. I think we should also watch Open Russia, his foundation. There's a lot more ambition there and strategy there than kind of looks like on a rather sort of vacant website. And the plan for that is based on Khodorkovsky's analysis that Bolotnaya failed because there was no way to take the energy of Moscow and the dynamism of activism in Moscow to the regions. And Khodorkovsky wants Open Russia to build a civic infrastructure across the region, so the next time protests happen in Moscow, there are people that can mobilize in Pskov and Izhevsk and Vladivostok. And he's, what I'm intrigued about is how this is even possible that he could be thinking about doing this, putting the money in. Why isn't somebody stopping him? Surely people are aware of this at the very top if we're talking about it. So that's intriguing. And I'm also intrigued about the fact that Hodorkovsky keeps on going around saying, I'm not an opposition leader. I'm not an opposition leader. I'm prepared to be the nation's crisis manager. And in the event of a national crisis, I'm here to lead the transitional period. And that, for me, is an appeal to people in the ruling elite that if things get very bad, I'm not going to put you in prison. And you remember my address. You know that I was a minister. You know that I was an oligarch. You know I'm one of you.
And unfortunately, Mark had to leave us because he has a class to teach. Sean, I wanted to get your reaction to what Ben was saying. As the economy gets worse, the repression's also going to get worse. And what are the implications of that? I mean, where could that lead us?
This leads us into a very darker Putinism, that's for sure. And I think it's an intriguing thing to look at. And I think what Ben is calling for analysts to do should be taken up and watched, because as we've seen over the last couple of years, the kind of rumor mill and the ideas that are coming out of the Duma, which I always wonder where these ideas are coming from. Are they coming from actual Duma members and their kind of, you know, fervency, or are they being signaled from above? It's really hard to say, but I think it's worth watching.
My sense is a little of both. I think people kind of have the ideas in their head that anything goes right now. I mean, I saw one that no Duma deputy should be allowed to leave the country without the permission of the speaker of the Duma. Now, as the economy gets worse, though, this is going to, again, drive Russia into China's arms. It's going to. But it's not going to be as a partner, it's going to be, as Mark so aptly put it, as the loan shark. And Russia will be China's junior partner. How do we see that playing out? I mean, Russia as China's junior partner, because the way I see it playing out is the exact same conflicts Russia has with the West now, or not the exact same ones, but analogs of the same ones we have now, are going to play out in the East. I don't know how you say Banderovtsy in fascist in Chinese, but I bet we're going to be hearing about them, like in Mongolia or something, pretty soon, for example, you know, because China and Russia are competitors in Central Asia. They are. And if Russia, the whole aim of this is empire, or at least some dreams of empire, that's going to bump into China just as much as it's going to bump into the West. So, I mean, does China's junior partner work for Russia as a solution?
I don't think. I think it's more of Russia as a potential colony of China in many respects, as basically funneling China natural gas and oil, and China paying them in return at very low prices. It doesn't. I think the scenario is actually worse than junior partner for Russia.
Ben, would you agree with that?
I had some interesting discussions with the team around Mr. Shuvalov, who work very closely on this pivot to China, and it's a very good team. It's a very high quality. They know a lot about China, and there is some kind of good capacity there. But they appear to me to be wildly over-optimistic in what China can give, how much money China can provide, how far China will go. And they also appear to take for granted that China will find itself in conflict with the United States, and that's the subtext for a lot of this talk, is that they think that sooner or later America's going to come after China, and that's going to be what finally creates and makes this relationship that Putin has invested so much into. There are a couple of things they're doing, some of which are real, some of which are not. Energy, I think there's more to the energy relationship, and it's been more impressive for Russia than Western analysts give it credit for. I think there's a lot going on in terms of the Hong Kong dollar. Certainly they're very excited about that, with Russian money being placed in Hong Kong. And this is a lot for private individuals and sanctioned individuals. I think there's a lot of effort being placed in the replacement for SWIFT. I think there's something there. But in terms of large-scale, gigantic Chinese banks lending to the Russian economy, that's just not happening.
Yeah, and that's what they need more than anything, as much as the energy.
That's not happening, and I don't think that can happen. and I don't think Chinese banks are willing to take on that risk or in a position to, is that the Chinese capital market is not deep enough. It's just not there. It just can't replace this. I think I had a chance to speak to Russian officials and European officials about their relationship with China, and what struck me is that the Chinese appear to be very good at making either side sort of hear what they want. Is that the Chinese are telling the Europeans, it's all talk, just don't worry about it. And they are telling the Russians sort of almost the exact inverse, sort of, it's coming, it's just a bit, you know, it's just a bit delayed.
Is there any sense in the people you talk to that, you know, that Russia's ambitions are going to ultimately and probably inevitably bump into China's? Is there interest?
I think that one of the things that's really kind of like surprises me about the Western press, and especially about the think tank community in Brussels and in London, is how over-eager they have been to dramatize the so-called threat from China and underplay the threat from Russia. Is that China, in columns in the FT, in reports from CFR, ECFR, or Brookings, is presented as this power that's sort of years away or moments away from becoming annexationist and avaricious, whereas Russia is sort of dismissed as a sort of faded old, a faded, decaying person that's not much of a risk to anyone apart from itself.
There's some truth. China is a rising power, and I do believe Russia is a falling power, but China's been a
far more responsible stakeholder, and China has
placed vast
efforts in maintaining a positive relationship with the United States. And I think China is actually unfairly caricatured by lots of the Western establishment.
Well, and who's coming out the winner in this thing? It's looking to me like it's going to be China in this whole
thing. I did a long trip of going around Siberia looking for Chinese migrants, and I just didn't find them in 2012. I found some, but you know, I live in London, and there are more Chinese people in London than there are in Siberia, and there's a higher Chinese percentage of the population of Great Britain than there is of Russia. And I think that this yellow peril, it's as much an American fantasy as it is a Russian fantasy. Because America has its own deep visions and fears of China and of China taking Siberia and white lands being lost to Asians. And the fact that when you speak about Russia in the West, this idea of China devouring Siberia just comes minutes afterwards, reflects to me something about our own psychology. And I did a bit of research into Chinese migration patterns, and China is suffering from a giant migration crisis. If China does not have enough workers to keep its factories going, there are not enough peasants in China to fill Guangzhou and Fuzhou and Shanghai and Wenzhou, and they don't have the people to colonize Siberia. And this sort of like 1970s image of yellow hordes waiting to go and sort of farm Krasnoyarsk is just not there. And we need more of a crossover between Chinese demographic analysis and Russian study.
Yeah. Sean, any thoughts on China here before I wanted to move to one more thing before we wrapped up?
Yeah, I wonder how much, in following what Ben is saying, how much China actually, you know, Russia is knocking on China's door, how much China is knocking on Russia's door. Because from my limited knowledge of China, China seems to be more interested in Africa. Here you have actual migration to Africa from China, then China is interested in Eurasia. So I wonder how that might play out if there ever will be a shift from the Chinese perspective into Eurasia, or it will continue to focus on, say, Africa.
It's very difficult and unprofitable for a lot of that migration to Africa comes from small Chinese states and businesses, and it's Chinese cities sponsoring ties with countries that can provide them with raw materials. And they do it because it's quick and it's easy and it's profitable. Establishing a Chinese presence in Cheetah is difficult, complicated, confusing, and Chinese simply do not want to go there. Like when I interviewed Chinese people living in the Russian Far East, they hated it. They were frightened, it was cold, people were violent. People who move to Africa enjoy it. They like it. It's like good weather. They live well. They're respected and they're not frightened.
That's an interesting point. Well, before we wrap up, I wanted to touch on one thing here, going back to what we discussed in the first half. And this move from pragmatism to ideology, from the old Putinism to the new Putinism, is basically predicated on a promise of empire. Let's face it. I mean, Putin offered his people an empire and they wept with joy. How far can the empire myth take you when your empire, and that's in quotes, consists of Abkhazia, South Ossetia, Transnistria, Crimea, and maybe Donbass?
Iraq was an empire. Saddam Hussein's Iraq was ruled and sold to the population as an empire, even though it never really conquered any territory. Right. I don't think your empire has to be linked to your territorial size.
So, so they can sell this empire myth without much of an empire?
Well, in its own way, Israel is an empire, and Israel's tiny. The empire consists of like 7 villages in the West Bank. You know, it's just like the myth of glory and land. It's got nothing to do with size.
Uh-huh. Sean, would you agree that?
It's not really an empire on territory. It's an empire of people, right? It's a consolidation of the Russian-speaking people into this under Russia's banner. So I think this is more the issue. If you see where Russia has expanded into the areas you mentioned, one of the things that holds them all together is the Russian-speaking people. And this is, I think, what when Putin speaks about empire or speaks about expanding Russia, this is what he's speaking about. I don't think he necessarily means territory.
Yeah, but a counterpoint to that, and again, we talked about this in the podcast last week when we discussed the Russians of Ukraine. He's lost a fairly important part of that Russian-speaking world, according to polls I've seen, because the Russians of, for example, Odessa and Kharkiv oblasts in Ukraine are overwhelmingly and decisively and vehemently anti-Putin, and they want to get themselves safely in a westward moving Ukraine as fast as possible. So I mean, there's going to be a big part of this Russian world missing. It doesn't matter. We could sell the myth. I mean, I could see that, but they could still sell this myth and use it as something to sustain this regime. No.
I'm not sure if he could, how far he could sustain it. And I always think that he could play. Part of me thinks that he could play with it for a while,
right?
In the sense that this idea of consolidating Russian civilization, it all follows into making Russia into a separate place than the outside world, right? All this anti cosmopolitanism, kind of consolidating Russian society around, putting it behind internet walls or media walls, however it may be. I think he can play this as long as there is a perception he can also play that Russia is besieged from outside.
Mm. Ben, would you agree, or any last thoughts before we...
I think it's very important not to talk about Russia in the metaphor of like a drug addict, is that people keep on referring to what's happened with Crimea as if Russia has just injected something, and it's very high right
I've been
now,
guilty
we'll
of that.
But we'll go back to normal. And I think when countries go through kind of like wars or decisive conflicts or victories, they don't go back to normal, they change. And again, Israel's a very useful example, which is the 1967 war in Israel transformed that country. Israel didn't go back, never went back to 1966. And I think that with Russia, there is a pre-Crimea and a post-Crimea in the public mind. And I don't think we can expect things to be the way they were before.
Well, just sticking with the drug addict metaphor that I've used shamelessly and repeatedly is that I likened it to cocaine, but it means they keep needing more. They're not going to go back to normal.
That's needing more. I agree with.
But at one point, at some point, you if you keep needing more, you take too much and you you have a heart attack or something, right? I mean, if you want to push the metaphor.
Well, I think looking at history, cantankerous, vaguely poor, oppressive, romantic nationalist regimes, they can last.
Mm.
They don't last very happily or very well. They don't meet their targets. They don't live up to their potential. But they can go on for a long time.
Mm.
Like the late Soviet Union went on for decades. And one interesting rumor that's going around Brussels is that if Putin is prepared to embrace the war footing, Putin is rumoured to be thinking about disengaging more heavily from global capital markets to remove his weak spots. That's just one rumour that I've heard.
Yeah, no, I've heard some arguments made that he wants us to build the wall. That what Bolotnaya taught him when the technocrats in his circle were saying you got to negotiate with the street. And he's saying, whoa, these guys are a little bit too integrated into the Western economy, and this is dangerous for us. We got to have a wall, but I don't want to build it. I don't want Russia to be the one that builds it this time. Let's make the West build it.
That's very interesting. Yeah.
It's an interesting. I'm not sure if I believe it, but it's certainly as plausible as anything I've heard until now. Okay, well, on that note, we'll wrap it up for today. That's all we have time for. I'd like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from New York City has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at NYU, an expert on Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us via Skype from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, has been Sean Guillory of the University of Pittsburgh's Center for Russian and Eastern European Studies and author of Sean's Russia blog. And joining us on Skype from London has been journalist and Kremlin watcher Ben Judah, author of the book Fragile Empire, How Russia Fell In and Out of Love with Vladimir Putin. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
And I'd like to also thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my awesome and indispensable colleague, Pavel Butorin, proprietor of the equally awesome and indispensable Twitter feed, Russia Police Watch, which you can and should follow at Rus Police Watch. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and the newly launched Power Vertical feed at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. Join us again next week. And now, as always, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.